Tony Schwartz is in the audience tonight, and he is an expert in this very department. The power of giving effect without thinking is entirely within his domain. But, you see, the advertisers have been puzzled for a long time in their surveys to discover that people don't really read ads until they own the thing. And if you own that icebox or that car, then you notice the ads very much, because this is how you get your satisfaction. The ad world then becomes an enormous area of information service, part of the service industries, enabling you to substitute the effect for the thing, just like Picasso. But no, the artists have been usually go through these maneuvers 50 or more years before the engineers get around to them. And so the advantage of knowing art is orientation in a complex world.
So distantly I turn to view the shamblings of that motley crew, those souls that hate the strength that mine has, steeled in the school of old Aquinas. These are the words of Joyce in his little poem, The Holy Office, referring to the role of the artist. And it's a very useful introduction to the relation between Joyce and Aquinas. I'm going to point to another strange item, namely that Maria Montessori did her PhD on Thomas Aquinas and discovered the importance of the sensory life as the agent in educational training, especially of backward children, from her study of Aquinas, so that the whole Montessori system of education, with its stress on the senses, later to be developed by Piaget, was from Aquinas. Joyce calls Aquinas Toucher Tom in Finnegan's Wake and has a good deal of fun with Toucher Tom, because Aquinas had opted for touch as prior and prime in all sensory knowledge and all knowledge whatever. And this is itself an excellent way in which to move into Aquinas' relation to modern poetry and the arts. There's one way of getting into this is through the very nature of the Thomistic article, the scholastic form of disputation, meditation. Anyone familiar with the use which Joyce makes of the labyrinth figures as the archetype of human cognition will have noticed this same figure as it appears in the dramatic action of a Thomistic article. This and much more was grasped by the young Joyce, who seems to have been the first to make explicit the relation in Aquinas between the stages of apprehension and the creative process. This is made plainer in a passage in the portrait of the artist, to which Joyce brings to bear the wisdom of Aquinas on the matter of beauty. Aquinas says then, as quoted in the portrait, there are three things needed for beauty: wholeness, harmony, and radiance. And these notes of beauty are part of the cognitive awareness, the intellectual awareness of man. And it is the Thomistic view that beauty relates to a cognitive rather than to a volitional power. It is in Stephen Hero that there are the texts which explain what Joyce understood by natural process and how beauty follows the natural process of learning. For Stephen, art was neither a copy nor an imitation of nature. The artistic process was a natural process, a veritably sublime process of one's own nature, which had a right to examination and open discussion. And Joyce brought attention to the apprehensive faculty, the modes of awareness, the modes of learning, as themselves the basis or substratum of the creative process itself. It is noteworthy that Joyce excludes from the aesthetic discussion in the portrait just those features of the Thomistic analysis of cognition which are most important to him as a mature artist, because in the portrait he is concerned not with the mature artist but the artist as a young man, and therefore he left out those really mature considerations about art as the mode of apprehension, which he later stressed.
Came along, oh, how strange. general question about your upcoming presidential campaign. We here in Toronto were influenced a lot by Marshall McLuhan, who taught in Toronto, and he talked about how issues, political issues, could not be communicated effectively under TV conditions. You know, once TV is a general environment, which has happened since the 50s, issues have been hard to get across to the people. Now, your group is very issue-oriented. I was wondering how you could deal with that problem of the television environment. How do you develop support, considering...
Well, I put on 15 in 1984, 15 nationwide half-hour television broadcast, which did have quite a cumulative impact reverberating around the United States today. But nonetheless, the more fundamental thing. McLuhan's thesis is partly true and partly not true. What is true is that as the society has been becoming worse and worse, the standpoint of the desperate private citizen, the private citizen and the household have retreated more and more from reality in the larger scale, limiting themselves to immediate concerns of family and community or personal career. Apart from those limited, narrow issues, the citizen has been retreating into entertainment.
In case you didn't know, this is Lyndon LaRouche.
Various types, the hedonistic, exotic things floating around, but more particularly television. So the worse things get, the more the family, in effect, digs a deeper foxhole and hides from that foxhole, from reality, watching the television set. Now, what happens then, somebody at some point begins dropping hand grenades or mortar shells into the foxhole. Then the citizen gets out. That is, once the entertainment withdrawal from reality, the escapism, once that escapism no longer provides the illusion of security to the private citizen, the citizen comes out and becomes, as has happened in the past, radicalized. Now, the citizen can become radicalized for better or for worse. And if people don't come along with better, then the citizen will, on the basis of the record of history, usually go for worse. And that's the process we're in now. The AIDS pandemic, which has hits right into the family, is having an effect on a significant part of the population of the United States now. The economic collapse has reached the point that the illusion which existed in the past couple of decades, the period of great withdrawal into the mean, that's coming to an end too. The Graham-Rudman bill in the United States is the first development of this type which has begun to impact the citizens, the local citizens, in terms of the larger political process. We cannot predict at present what the Graham-Rudman impact will be on the congressional elections of this year. It will probably be significant. The degree of impact is presently unpredictable. There are a number of unknowns. But we are now in a process in which the hand grenade and mortar shells are dropping into the private foxhole. The citizens are coming out of the foxhole, forgetting the television tube a bit, coming back into reality, and slightly angry about it at the same time,
yes,
taking out of their warm foxhole. And that's the way the process is going.
Okay, McLuhan recommended back in the 60s that television would be such a devastating environment, the disservice of it, that he recommended shutting it off. You're highlighting the service of the situation and the disservice. Would you recommend turning the electric environment, the television environment off? Would you?
Well, what we're doing in the United States, I would say turn a good deal of it off. The people are sitting there watching television in families and have to set on 10, 12 hours a day. And when they're saturating themselves, in addition to the regular broadcast, with this cable broadcaster, they are really going into paranoia and watching any entertainment medium too many hours a day, even if it were good, introduces paranoia because too much time is being spent on fantasy life and too little on reality. And when people are more involved with the TV characters than they are with the neighbors, then they're becoming paranoid. And therefore, I would say, shut it off a good deal of the time and restrict TV usage to things that are more important and more essential. Particularly, turn off the soap opera. Don't watch it. Keep away from the game show. Restrict overdoses of sports watching. And use TV's properly and if we had good programs. So don't shut it off altogether, but restrict it. Take a sane approach toward television watching.
As a Republican policy, that would be a principle of administration.
Well, I would recommend that strongly whether I have anything to do with what I'm doing as a party spokesman or not.
Okay, is there any more time?
Many chaise lounges and all her admirers coming to her, and then customers can't afford her anymore. She's so beautiful. They can't afford her price, even.
And that's when you become a queen.
There's a wonderful Montana. She came to New York, you know. She was a cowpuncher, and she'd grown wealthy, and she said there was a fellow in the town who wanted to have an affair with her. So he said, my price is about $1,000, she says to her. Well, he says, I couldn't afford that. Have a heart. And he had a heart attack afterwards. Well, I said, that's why. Because he couldn't have the $1,000 to have an affair with you. That's why he died. Someone said, you shouldn't have it. Well, I said, what a wonderful way to die.
That's
Look, we better stop or they'll be doing something. They'll be cutting our wires off here. We're burning them. They're going into ashes, these people that are listening in to us. We don't want them all into ashes. We want some of their guts in them.
So do you think that'd be the best way to die while you were making love?
Oh, sure, sure, Bobby. You do die if you know how to die when you're doing it.
Yeah. These are other things you won't tell the people, right?
Bobby. Oh, my God, who can even take one word you say and understand it?
Well, this is the title of Gare's new book, Everything I Won't Tell You.
All I did tell you, all I didn't tell you, all I would tell you, all I couldn't tell you, all I will tell you, all I shall tell you, all I'll never tell you. And it's that way, the jeu de mots, and the wills, and the woods, and the hips, and the hips, and the hips, and the hips. Bye, Blackbird. Don't hit me when your wings go by me, that's all. Or I'll hit the party, and you'll never have the wings on you again, Blackbird. My army, you'll fly you somewhere else, and you'll never fly by me again, Blackbird. Oh, that bird. Well, Bobby, anyway, you can't say you haven't visited me this time of 83 in Dartmouth, in the big city of the world.
And you've been in
And you come from the smallest village in the world to the biggest city in the world, and you think we live in Hicks down here. We're Kalons down here, every one of us, you know. I'm developing them day by day. I have a factory of them now. Did you know that?
Yes. You
put some bee in my ear and put it somewhere else, too. Well, the good thing you put it somewhere else, too, is you put it in my ear, too, because it's better that way.
This is Garrett's oversoul talking now. This is Garrett's real self coming through. This is where you get all your money, Garrett, from the back
shut
house.
Up, Garrett, will you shut up? I better go before I faint.
No, don't
all
faint.
All right. Come to see you tonight when it's very late. Between the meadow and the sea, a voice in rapture calleth you and me. And the tide is going out, and the moon is full, and you are fuller than the moon, and you are higher than the tide. Goodbye, Finnegan's Wake, till I see you on that tide and in that moon.
And we'll work with May
and
tonight.
And cheerio, and all the cherries, and may they be redder than the ones of Pomona, the orchards of Alesi by the rivers of forgetfulness, for the streams of sands to sea. Bye-bye, Blackbird. Goodbye, Nightingale. Farewell, Linnet. Say hello to that skylark when she sings her song before the morn shows her breasts and her big eyes on me again. Goodbye, Finnegan's Wake.
Goodbye, Finnegan.
Till I see you then. I'll be waiting for you, Finnegan's Wake.
Democracy, democracy. In dreams. In dreams.
Hallelujah. Come to the altar and I'll give you mass. I'll give you something you never had before, boy.
You can do it. You can do it.
Oh, God.
You can do it. You're the
never
high
again
priest
will
of
I talk like this in the earth to anyone. Now, we'll make a recording of it, Bobby. Put it in that subconscious of yours and write it back and play it back to me some Christmas Eve when the children are talking about when they were children and the mothers are talking about when they had lovers. The farms are talking about when they had their fields. Play it back to me someday, will you?
We have made a recording of it.
All right, okay.
We have it for you right now.
All right, Bobby. Call me tonight, late tonight.
Garetto.
I'll be seeing
but
you.
But the jelly.
I'll be seeing you. Every party, make a sculpture of you. Make a face of you.
You're the Jimmy Joyce of Dartmouth.
Kiss, kazay, ooh, la, la. Bonsoir, these ain't gonna snatchers. Don't snatch me in the bonus snatchers. Don't snatch the...
You're the Santa
Open
Claus.
The latch, but don't snatch the satch or the latch.
You're the Santa
Give
Claus.
Give the
satch
or the latch. Make it pink ribbon over that satch or that latch.
I'm not talking. Bye.
Saturday Morning Live, your progressive 2-hour Saturday morning fix. Tune in every Saturday at 10 for the people's side of politics, the arts, and the international news. From the person on the street to the phone-in segments of Clifton Joseph's commentary. It's all yours every Saturday morning, live at 10 on 88.1 CKLN. Saturday Morning Live.
Hello, this is Bob's Talk Show. It's a reverse radio show where we call out rather than you call in, and we're interested in your opinion on various topics. You willing to engage?
terms of what it's all about.
Well, I'm going to bring up a topic, and then we can interact.
Would you explain who you are to me once more?
Bob is my radio name, and this is Bob's Talk Show.
Bob's Talk Show? On what radio station?
I sell it to various, we never know whoever buys it. It's sort of like an entrepreneurial way of doing a talk show.
All right.
So the topic tonight is the discarnate experience. Now, the word discarnate, the way I mean it is that while you're on the phone and I'm on the phone, you are in the room I'm in, your voice is at least, and I'm in your room. In other words, we're in two places at the same time, which the human body cannot do. Right? You follow that?
Is yours a comic show?
Yes, it can be. We sometimes have to sell it that way.
Get hold of those technological secrets both inside and outside the Soviet Union. On this map, the Russian city of Fergana is forbidden to all foreigners. Bacteriological science and physics, some of which we cannot yet understand, make it a haven for spies. Here is made antimatter. A gram of it would wipe out London in a few seconds. Actually, it is antimercury. And on contact with real mercury, it produces an explosion without end. Here, too, Bruno Pontecorvo, turncoat spy, has developed a telescope that can see through the Earth to the other side. At this Chinese town, scientists have perfected a machine to collect large amounts of lightning over towns. This electrical charge lowers the brain of man to that of an animal. Already tests have proved successful with prisoners. In California, a U.S. scientist has developed californium. Shot from an ordinary rifle, it has the power of an H-bomb. This is Dugway, Utah, where U.S. scientists have a defoliant. a small amount of which is enough to kill the population of the Earth. This in itself is enough to justify high-level espionage today. Here at Baikonur, Russia, a man, Kozarev, has harnessed time as a source of military energy, and another, K. Vasilich, has developed a beam which can control the brain of a man walking down the street on the other side of the road. Now these are known facts, not science fiction. They are few among many. But what of other horrors yet unknown to us? Almost the only way to stop this ride into technological suicide is to make sure that they are not left behind. And that's where spies come in. US and British spies work actively out of Fergana and Baikonur and a dozen other secret towns, passing information through Tashkent and Kabul. They are all technical men. Of course, most spy networks are not in the remote corners of Russia and China. Between them, the KGB and the CIA have an estimated 300,000 agents. They are mostly in traditional centers such as London, Beirut, Paris, Vienna, and Moscow. And they live on the razor's edge. For not all of them are brilliant technologists. There's still a lot of work to do on the...
Now, I'd like you all to put on your imagination caps and try and see this scenario. It's the early hours of the morning and you can't sleep, so you decide to listen to the radio. You spin the dial and suddenly you hear these words. Good evening, this is Mae Brussel. The title of this program is World Watchers. This is program number 787. It's January 5th, 1987, and I have a story for you to start the new year with. Now, for the next hour, you hear Mae Brussel and nothing but Mae Brussel as she talks about the conspiracies that control our lives. She generally airs her program over KAZU in Pacific Grove, California, but she's widely syndicated in several U.S. states and can be heard in Canada on CKLN, the campus radio station of Ryerson Polytechnic in Toronto. I've got May on the line from her home in Carmel, California. Good morning, May.
Good morning.
How long have you been in the conspiracy business? How did you get started with this show?
Well, I started doing my research when John Kennedy was murdered. And that was in November of 1963. There were about 10 people in the world that started that day, and I was one of them. And I bought the Warren Commission hearings and spent 9 years researching and studying them, retyping them into about 28,000 pages. And then at the time of the Pentagon Papers in 1971, it'll be 17 years this month, I was invited to a radio station in Carmel. Those days the call letter was different. And they asked me to do an hour interview on the meaning of the Pentagon Papers. And I went into the historical perspective of the Pentagon Papers up to the Vietnam War in that one-hour broadcast, and people liked it so much they asked me to come back. And to keep in mind that Carmel is not only a very prosperous and semi-middle-to-the-right community, but it has six of the largest military bases in our area.
And Clint Eastwood is mayor.
Right now, he's the only mayor in the United States that carries a gun to work on. Okay.
Now, May, I know you can talk for a full hour on any aspect of your conspiracies, but what I'd like to know is, we've all heard of the communist conspiracy and the P2 conspiracy in Italy. What is special about yours, and can you just sort of keep it down to a brief 25 words, perhaps?
To say what is special about mine, there was a new book just published in Toronto that just came out at McGill University. Is that you or is that
in
Toronto?
That's in Montreal, but it's widely known here.
Let me give you the title of the book. It's beginning to sound like Mae Brussel's World Watchers, but it's from McGill University. This is the title on the front cover. I'm not reading a table of contents. What links the Mafia, the Vatican, the Moonies, the CIA, the cocaine barons, the banks, and you to hot money and the politics of death?
What does?
Well, it has to do with flight capital and the interconnections of these people. But the point is that I was years ahead of these people in making the connections of events that were not separate from each other. That's what makes me unique, is that, and now the other authors are catching on. When I was the first one and the only person on the air now, I'm starting my 17th year, doing an hour a week of these interconnections. Now, if you've heard one broadcast or two, you can't come to a conclusion. It's like catching a train from L.A. to New York. You stop through different cities to...